Here Joseph wept in his transparent misery, presided over by his understanding. He wept over poor Jacob, who would have to summon his endurance, and over the brethren's confidence in his death. He wept for weakness and giddiness from the exhalations of the well. But the more lamentable his situation became in the course of the 72 hours which he spent here below, the more clearly the undertones of his thoughts came out, the more deceptively his present mirrored itself in its heavenly prototype, so that by the end he no longer distinguished the heavenly from the earthly at all, and in the dreamy self-satisfaction of death saw only the unity of the double. We may with justice regard that as a device of nature to tide him over the unbearable, for the natural hope to which life clings up to the last needs a reasonable justification, and Joseph found it in this identification. Indeed, it extended beyond his life, his hope that he would not finally perish but somehow be saved out of the pit, for, literally speaking, he gave himself up for dead. There was the brethren's confidence. There was the bloody robe which Jacob should receive. The pit was deep, and return to his former life was inconceivable, a thought as monstrous as that the evening star might return out of the abyss wherein it was sunk, and the shadow be withdrawn from the dark moon that it should again be full. But the conception of the death of the planet, the darkening and setting of the sun, whose habitation becomes the lower world, included likewise the idea of reappearance, new light, resurrection, and therein Joseph's natural hope that he might live justified itself by faith. It was not a hope that he might return out of the grave into his former life, yet by its means the grave was defeated. Joseph cherished it not only for itself and for its own sake, but for the poor old man at home, whom he had brought down into the pit together with himself, and who would be stricken to the earth. It would probably be after the son's death that Jacob would receive the bloody robe. But if only the father could have faith beyond death, according to the ancient hope, then, thought Joseph in the grave, the blood of the beast would be taken, as once it had been, for the blood of the son. Chapter 6. The Stone Before the Grave. The Ishmaelites. Men came from Gilead, from the east, and beyond the river, rocking along on their camels, 4 or 5, with a few extra pack animals laden with wares, and with slaves and camel boys bringing their number up to 8 or 10. They were traveling merchants, at home neither here nor in the place whence they came. Strange men, very brown of face and hands, with felt circlets round their headcloths, each wrapped in a burnous with diagonal stripes. They had sharp eyes, showing the whites as they rolled them observantly round. One of their number, who rode at the head of the train, was of dignified age. A thick-lipped boy in a white cotton garment led his animal on a long rein, while the master sat in the high saddle, his head consideringly on one side, with his hands, wrapped in his mantle, resting on the saddle bow. It was clear that he was the head of the party. The others were his nephew, son-in-law, and sons. What manner of men were these? That can be told in general, and also with some precision. They lived in the south of the Edom Seir country, at the edge of the Arabian desert, on the Egyptian side. Their domain, which was a passage and crossing into the land of mud, was called Mizraim, another name for Egypt. But it was also called Muzri, and in another dialect, Mosar, or even Midian, after the son of Abram and Keturah. It was a colony of the people of Ma'in, farther south, near the land of incense, who traded between Arabia and the kingdom of beasts and of the dead. They had fixed market in western Canaan, and the land of the two rivers, and at Muzri, went to and fro with wares between the peoples, and convoyed all the state and royal caravans between one country and another. In other words, our travelers were Maonites, from Ma'in, or Minians, called Midianites. But since one scarcely distinguished between Medan and Midian, Abraham's sons by his desert concubine Keturah, they might be called Midianim as well as Midianites. It made no difference to them. Even if you gave them the generic name of all desert folk, taking not Keturah but Hagar the Egyptian as their foremother, and simply called them Ishmaelites, they had no objection either. It was of no importance to them what people called them and who they were. The main point for them was that they existed and could trade to and fro on the trade routes. Indeed, there was some reason to call the old man and his companions Ishmaelites, for, as men of Muzri, they were half Egyptian, as had been the fiery and beautiful youth named Ishmael. You might, loosely speaking, say that they were descended from him. This was no royal or state caravan coming on from the east. By no means. They were private travelers, bound on their own business and without ostentation. They had been marketing their wares on the hither side of the Jordan, at the fairs which were held on feast days. They sold Egyptian linens, coarse and fine, also pretty glass trifles of various kinds, taking in exchange, with a good profit to themselves, all sorts of sweetmeats, balsams, incense, and gums. And if on this side of the river they managed to acquire some of the native products, such as honey and mustard, a camel load of pistachios and almonds, they would be well content. As for their route, they were as yet undecided, whether to follow the road running north and south, which ran along the crest of the mountain, and would take them by way of Jerusalem and Hebron to Gaza by the sea, or whether they would do better first to keep to the north and east, and then by way of the Megiddo Plain reach the coast, and follow along it to their country, which was a passage and a crossing into the land of Egypt. It was past midday when they entered the valley, the old man in the lead, the others behind him in a row. They intended to see whether the people of Dothan were holding a fair where they could do business. They let their animals pace along on low ground, which fell away into a mossy slope, and their quick eyes spied below them the ruined steps and the masonry among the thickets. The old man, crooking his neck, saw it first. He pointed it out to the others, made them stop, and sent down the youth in the cap to spy out the place. For travelers such as these are explorers and inquisitive by nature, and must see all there is to see. The boy was not gone long. He simply jumped down and sprang up again, and announced with his thick lips that a covered well was below. "If it could be covered and hidden," said the old man shrewdly, "then it will be worth looking into. The people of the land hereabouts are jealous and stingy. I think it is possible that the well hath water of unusual coolness and freshness. We can use it and take our vessels full. I see nobody who could hinder us. Moreover, why are we called Ishmaelites if we may not take what we can in defiance of their jealousy? Take a skin and some bottles and let us go down." They did as he bade them, for he was their leader. They made their animals lie down, untied the vessels, and climbed down into the well chamber, uncle, nephew, son-in-law, and sons, with some of the slaves. They soon saw that the well had no bucket and no windlass, but that was no matter. They would let down a leather bottle and fill it with the jealously guarded water. The old man sat down on a fallen quarry stone, settled his clothing, and motioned with his dark-skinned hand that they should roll away the stone from the hole. The stone was broken in two. "This well," the old man said, "is covered indeed and hidden, but also it is in a very bad state. The children of the land seem jealous, but likewise heedless. Meanwhile I will cherish no doubts of the goodness of the water. That would be premature. Good. One half of the stone is rolled aside. Seize me now the other with your young arms, and lay it down beside its moss-grown sister on the flags. So doth now the round of the water within laugh in its purity, and is the mirror clear?" They stood close to the well, on the low ledge that ran round it, and bent over the depths. "The well is dry," said the son-in-law, still looking without turning his head toward the old man. As he said it, they all pricked up their ears. A wailing rose out of the depths. "It cannot be that the wailing cometh out of this hole," said the old man. "I trust not my ears. Let us be still and silent, and hearken if perchance we may hear it again." It wailed once more. "Now am I forced to trust my ears," the elder said. He stood up and mounted the step, shoving those aside with his arms who were in his way, and in his turn looked into the depths. The others waited courteously for his verdict, but his sight was already dim, and he saw naught. "Dost thou see anything, Mibsam, my son-in-law?" he asked. The son-in-law permitted himself to answer, "I see a white thing on the ground that moveth and seemeth like a being and a living thing." Kedar and Kedma, the sons, confirmed his words. "It is amazing," said the old man. "I confide in your sharp eyes, and will call to see if it will answer." "Hello!" he called down the well in his ancient high-pitched voice. "Who or what is it moaneth in this well? Is thy place native to thee, or wouldst thou be elsewhere?" They listened. There was a little pause. Then they heard faint and far away, "Mother, save thy son!" At once they were all excitement. "Up, no delay," the elder cried. "Bring a rope, that we may throw it down and draw the creature up to daylight, for plainly that abode is not native to him." "Here is no mother," he shouted down, "but we are pious people up here, who desire to save thee, if it is thy wish." "See now," he turned to his men, "what one may come upon in a journey. But this is more extraordinary than aught I have met between the two rivers. Was it not shrewdly done to spy out this hidden and covered well? And was it not I who proposed it? Men of small courage might falter or take to their heels. I can see in your faces that the thought has entered your minds, for it is uncanny to be spoken to thus out of the depths, and it is very possible that that which speaketh is the genius of the abandoned well, or some spirit of the abyss. But we must look at the matter on its practical side, and meet the situation with all our energy, for the wailing from below indicateth extreme need. Where is the rope?" He bent and called into the pit, "Canst thou seize a rope which we will throw and tie it round thee, that we may draw thee up?" Again there was a pause before answer came. Faintly it sounded, "I lie in bonds." The old man had put his hand to his ears, but the others had to repeat to him what the voice had said. "You hear," he said then, "in bonds it lieth. It both heighteneth his need and maketh harder our task. One of you must go down into the hole to loose the creature's bonds. Where is the rope?" "We have it. Mibsam, my son-in-law, I appoint thee to go down. Thou shalt be well attached to the rope, and it shall be like an arm which we stretch down into the depths and draw it up again with the bundle in it. So soon as thou hast it fast, thou must call out, and with our united powers we shall draw thee and our booty up to us again." Mibsam declared himself ready for good or for ill. He was a young man with a short face, a rather long, flat nose, and prominent eyes, whose whites gleamed in the darkness of his face. He took the headcloth from his curly hair, laid off his burnous, and lifted his arms to let himself be wound round with the rope. It was no hempen rope, but a cord of Egyptian papyrus, wonderfully softened, pounded, and smoothed, practically unbreakable. He knew its quality well, for the men carried several bales of it to sell. Soon son-in-law was tied and harnessed, ready to swing down. They all took part in winding him up, Epher, the old man's nephew, the sons, and the slaves. Then Mibsam sat down on the edge of the well, let go his hold, and dropped into the empty depths, while those at the rope braced their legs and passed it in little jerks through their hands. It soon slackened. Mibsam was on the ground. They could relax their legs and go to peer into the well. They could just hear his voice speaking to the creature down there, panting as he lifted him to attach the rope. "Haul up!" he cried then. They hauled away on the double burden, shouting in unison, while the old man stood by, directing them with gestures. Up came the son-in-law above the ruin, bearing in his arms the inhabitant of the well. Great was the amazement of the merchants when they saw the fettered boy. They lifted eyes and hands to heaven, shook their heads, and clacked with their tongues. They rested their hands on their knees to look at their prize as he sat on the step, leaning against the well, with hanging head, in his bonds, spreading abroad a moldy air. He wore an amulet on a bronze cord round his neck, and a ring with a lucky stone on his finger, but nothing else at all. His wounds were closed over and nearly healed by this time, and the bump on his eye so far reduced that he could open it. Now and then he did, though mostly he had kept both eyes shut. Now, however, he feebly lifted the long-lashed lids and looked upwards pathetically, but with interest, at his rescuers. He even smiled over their astonishment. "Merciful Mother of God," the old man said. "What have we fished up out of the depths? Is he not like the spirit of the abandoned well, miserable, wretched, and half-dead, when the water receded and left him stranded? But let us abide by the common-sense side of the affair, and the needs of this creature we have found, for from the practical point of view, he seems to me to be a boy of good quality, if not the best, and fallen into bad luck I know not how. Look well at those eyelashes, and the delicate growth of the limbs, however befouled they are and stinking from the pit. Kedar and Kedma, shame upon you for holding your noses, for sometimes he openeth his eyes. Loose him first from his fetters, cut them through. Now bring milk to refresh him. Wilt thy tongue obey thee, my son, to make us know who thou art?" Joseph might have found words, despite his feebleness, but he had no wish to speak, nor any thought of uncovering the family quarrel to these Ishmaelites. It was no affair of theirs. Therefore he only looked dyingly at the old man, and smiled piteously as with his freed hand he made a gesture of negation before his lips. He received milk and drank it out of a pot which a slave held for him, for his arms were lame from the bonds. He drank so greedily that a good part of the milk dribbled out of his mouth again directly he had done, as though he were a suckling. When the old man, upon this, asked him how long he had been in the pit, he stretched out three fingers in sign that it had been 3 days, which the Meneans found very significant and thrilling, in view of the 3 dark days of the moon. When they asked how he got into the pit, in other words, who had thrown him in, he confined his answer to a gesture and motioned with his forehead upwards, so that one could not tell whether men had done so to him or heavenly powers been in play. But when they asked him again who he was, he whispered, "Your servant," and collapsed, so that they were none the wiser. "Our servant," repeated the elder. "Well, in so far as he is a foundling, and without us would not have had breath for his nostrils, I know not what to think, but so much I see. There is a mystery here, for many such there are in the world, as sometimes on journeys one discovereth to one's great amaze. Naught remaineth to us to do but to take this creature with us, for here can we not leave him, nor yet here build huts until he get his strength. I find," he added, "that this lad from the well toucheth my heart in some way, I know not how. For it is not pity alone, nor the mystery about him, but about every human being there is an encircling ring, which is not his own flesh, but yet of his flesh, and light or dark as the case may be. Old, experienced eyes perceive it better than young, heedless ones who look indeed but do not see. Now, as I look fixedly at this foundling, his aura seemeth to me strikingly light, and I conceive that he is the sort of find which one doth not throw away. I can read tablets and write cuneiform, said Joseph, lifting himself a little. Then he fell back again. You hear? Asked the elder, after he had had Joseph's words repeated to him. He can write, and is well brought up. Then is he worth finding, as I said, and not made to be left lying. We will take him with us, for thanks to my inspiration, which led me to look into the well, nobody can say us nay, or call us robbers, because we exercise a finder's right, and do not trouble overmuch to ask after those who threw away, or heedlessly lost, what we have found. If the owners turn up, we have a right to a reward and ransom, and it looketh as though we shall make something either way. Come, put this mantle upon him, for he came naked and foul out of the depth, as from the body of his mother, and is, as it were, twice born.